طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is John Roberts. Again this week, we have a full-featured program. In November of 2015, the Boston University Chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine held a conference featuring Middle East scholar, author, and activist Muin Rabbani and author and professor Norman Finkelstein, who have just authored a book together on solving the Israel-Palestine conflict. Last week, we heard Muin Rabbani's presentation, where he focused on Palestine's moving from the suffocation of the Oslo peace process to a strategy of more reliance on the United Nations and the international community in search of support for ending the Israeli occupation. He stressed that any resolution of the conflict will depend on Palestine getting their political house in order and recognition secured in international law to their right of return to their land and property. This week, we hear from Norman Finkelstein. Here is Norman Finkelstein speaking at Boston University.
Well, I want to resume where Muin left off, in particular on two points. I'll begin with the last one, which is, as Muin said, you don't know where things are headed. It's a moment which is pregnant with possibility, but it could all be aborted very quickly. It may last for years, or it may even turn into just a fleeting moment. We really don't know. And that's all the more reason why we have to concentrate our energy now. Because if you miss a historical moment, then you miss a huge historic possibility. And then the conflict can just drag on and on and on and on. And so we have to do all in our power to capitalize on that moment, which for all we know might not last all that long. Now, having said that, Muin also remarked that as promising as possibilities might be, he said that it has to be embedded in a strategy. You can't carry on in a random, unfocused fashion. There has to be a strategy. And as he said, one of the aspects of the strategy is to mobilize people. That's the goal, to reach out to a public, not only in Europe, but a public even in the United States, that the first time in living memory is ready to listen. If you look at the polls, not just in Europe, but also in North America, Israel's stock has significantly declined. I wouldn't say, as in Europe, it's plummeted, and it has in Europe consistently in polls taken by the BBC World Service. Israel over the last 10 years has been consistently, if we can use the word, lumped together with Iran, Pakistan, and North Korea, as having the most negative influence in the world, in every country in Europe, virtually every country in Europe. It's not true that public opinion has become so hostile to Israel and the United States, but it is true that public opinion has significantly changed. So to take the most recent example, two polls were taken, one by Pew, one by the BBC, both are very reputable polling agencies. Two polls were taken on the attitudes among many countries, including the United States, on the question of Palestinian statehood. Now, of the countries polled, every single one, bar none, in every single country polled, either a plurality or a majority supported Palestinian statehood. That's not altogether surprising, except that when I say every single country polled, surprisingly, that included the United States, where a plurality, approximately 45% of Americans said they supported the Palestinian bid for statehood, and depending on the poll, 24 or 36% opposed it. Now you have to appreciate, as only an American can, how remarkable that is. Because the President of the United States, Mr. Obama, was dead set against Palestinian statehood. Both houses of Congress passed resolutions condemning Palestinian statehood. Both political parties condemned Palestinian statehood, and the full gamut of the mainstream media opposed Palestinian statehood. Nonetheless, a plurality of Americans managed to see through the lies, see through the misinformation and disinformation, and supported its statehood. And you can cite many other polls which give similar indication that public opinion in the U.S. is changing, and not just among Americans in general, but public opinion among American Jews in particular. It's also significantly changed. And for reasons which are fairly obvious, on a moment's reflection, because American Jews are overwhelmingly liberal. Since at least the 1930s, American Jews have overwhelmingly voted for the Democratic Party, and on all polls that are taken, American Jews define themselves on the spectrum of conservative, moderate, liberal. American Jews define themselves in percentages as liberal, much higher than any other ethnic or religious group in the United States. If you look at the last presidential election, 80% of American Jews voted for Barack Obama. Latinos, who came in third, first African Americans, who was over 90%, American Jews, 80%, Latinos, it was about 63% voted for Mr. Obama. Now, if you factor in income, American Jews now being by far and away the wealthiest religious ethnic group in the U.S., they should be voting Republican if you vote by your pocketbook, as most people do. But no, American Jews are liberal. They vote Democratic. And liberal in the United States, it generally means belief in the rule of law, belief in equality before the law, belief in international institutions, belief in the peaceful resolution of a conflict. That's what liberal means in the American context. And the simple fact is, American Jews now know too much. they can no longer reconcile their liberal convictions, their liberal tenets, their liberal beliefs with the way Israel carries on. It's simply not possible any longer to reconcile. And it's particularly true among young American Jews, those who attend schools like Boston University, where you're young, you're Jewish, you're idealistic, you're liberal, which is the profile, overwhelmingly, of college age American Jews. Young, liberal, idealistic. Well, if you fit that profile, as most American Jewish college students do, you don't want to have to go before the public. In 2006, during the Israeli attack on Lebanon, they dropped in the last 72 hours of the war, when a UN resolution had already been passed and the ceasefire was supposed to go into effect. And Israel used the last 72 hours to drop 4 million cluster bomblets on South Lebanon. You're young, you're Jewish, you're liberal, you're idealistic. You don't want to defend that. You're young, you're Jewish, you're liberal, you're idealistic. During Israel's invasion of Gaza in 2008-09, they dropped white phosphorus, a substance that reaches 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. They dropped it in two hospitals. You're Jewish. You don't want to have to defend that. If you're Rush Limbaugh's son, Sarah Palin's daughter, Michelle Bachmann's whatever, is she still around? Kane is getting all the headlines now, so I know. If you're them, yeah, you'll defend it. You know, some people will defend breaking the kneecaps of nuns, but it's not a Jewish thing. And so all the polls show that there has been a steady decline in American Jewish support for Israel and among younger Jews ages 40 and under. There has been a significant decline, so much so that there's a vast amount of literature now talking about how to, among the Jewish community, talking about how to reverse this significant decline. And you can see it at work in the universities, even in your own school. There was a time when Israel IDF soldiers used to tour the universities to be celebrated, in particular by the Jewish students, as war heroes. But in more recent years, the college Hillels, they drag the IDF soldiers on tours, with the purpose of the tours is to try to convince Jewish students that they aren't war criminals. It's changed. And Israel and its propaganda outfits and its lobby, they know the battle has been lost. And that's why they desperately work behind the scenes to try to get events like this one canceled, because they know they cannot any longer win the battle for public opinion. They have lost in the court of public opinion. And so they work behind the scenes, making all sorts of threats about withholding alumni funds and feeling unsafe when this or that speaker comes. All of these kinds of petty, silly tactics in order to suppress any open discussion, because they know in any open discussion it's a lost cause. They've lost. And so now we have the opportunity of trying to build a movement, trying, as Mouin said, to develop a strategy, develop goals, and, as he said, mobilize people to try for once and for all to put this conflict behind us. Because a kind of sentiment has settled in that this thing will never end. And I think there is an opportunity now, and we have to change our mindset. The mindset which we've had for decades now, and regrettably, I have to say decades now, that mindset needs to be changed. I see Susan Akram in the audience, who I first met, I'm afraid to say, about 30 years we're heading. Where are we now? 21 years ago. Mouin, we're coming on 30 years, because I think it was about 85, right? Yeah. And it's sort of like, it's going to just continue on and on and on. But I think now there is a possibility to reach a resolution and turn the Israel-Palestine conflict not into a subject of current events, but a subject of history, a past event. And we really have to believe that, not as an act of faith, but believe it because there are new possibilities. And then the question is, okay, what's the strategy? How do you mobilize people? And here it seems to me a useful person to look at to provide some insight and guidance is to look at the Mahatma, Mr. Gandhi, because he faced a challenge not unlike the one the Palestinians confront. India was trying to end an occupation, and the occupation was by the most formidable military and economic and political power of its day, namely the British. And the Palestinians are also trying to end an occupation, and if the immediate adversary is a regional power, the overarching adversary is the leading political economic power of our day, namely the United States. So, how do you begin? What do you do? Well, I did take some time a couple of years ago to plow through a large part of Mr. Gandhi's collected works, which are quite substantial. They run to 100 volumes, 500 pages a volume. Gandhi had a lot to say. In fact, not mostly about politics in a narrow sense. Most of his collected works are given over to diet and health. He was a kind of premature Oprah, but with a rather narrower waistline. And don't let the pictures and the cover for a magazine fool you. It's a miracle what you can do with the angle on lenses. In any event, I did go through a large part of his collected works, and I think he had a lot of quite useful insight, some of which bears directly on the topic of my part of this evening's lecture. And the most important insight, I think, from Gandhi was that politics is not about trying to change public opinion. You're not trying to bring enlightenment to the benighted masses. Politics is about trying to get people to act on what they already know is wrong. And everybody has that experience. You get up in the morning, and from the moment the day begins to the moment the day ends, you look around you, that's wrong, that's just not right, that's unfair, that shouldn't be. There are 1,000 things that we already know are wrong, but we don't act on them, including myself. And for Gandhi, the art of politics is to stimulate people to act on what they already know is wrong. The purpose of nonviolent civil disobedience was trying, as he called it, to quicken the conscience, to quicken the conscience, the dead conscience of the public into action. So I see that Susan has a perplexed look in her eyes, and I do try to give concrete examples because abstractions rarely have an impact. So concretely, what does that mean? Well, I go jogging in my neighborhood, and there's an overpass along the boulevard, and underneath the overpass, every winter, there are always Mexican workers sleeping there. And every time I pass them, every time I make a resolution, it must be at least a decade now, I make the resolution, I'm going to give them one of my winter coats. Because they're buried underneath these raggedy, dirty blankets. And as it happens, I have a closet full of winter coats. I have one going all the way back to when I was 16. It was a Mighty Mac, and it was a mighty good winter coat, which is why I've kept it. Do you remember the Mighty Mac? No, all the people won't remember. You, I'm asking. Do you remember it? No. Okay. You're obviously not from the United States. You're an alien. Well, I have all these old winter coats, but as many times as I resolve, I'm going to give them a winter coat. I just never do. I never follow up on what I know is wrong. Now, I know, knowing me, that were it the case that 30 or 40 people were to block the boulevard where I live and were saying we're committing this act of nonviolent civil disobedience to try to shake the conscience of people, to remind them there are all these homeless people who are in these frigid temperatures and they need coats. And if somebody were to do that, or some people were to do that, I know I'd be the first one out there carrying not one, but at least 5 of my winter coats and giving them to the homeless. And that's what Gandhi said politics is about, trying to get people to act on what they already know is wrong. But there's one qualification. The qualification is that not only must your means be just, that is, nobody can find exception to using nonviolent civil disobedience, not only must your means be just, but in the public's eye, your goal also has to be just. If they don't agree with your goal, then however just your means are, you will never get people to act. So what does that mean concretely? Well, let's take the case of the United States. Most public opinion polls show that Americans are divided right down the middle on the question of abortion. 50% are pro-choice, 50% are pro-life. So, let's just imagine, doing a thought experiment, if the 50% of Americans who are pro-life, all of them were to converge on the abortion clinics in the United States, and they said, we are going to fast unto the death until these physicians stop performing abortions. Their means, no reasonable person can quarrel with. They are absolutely nonviolent, and they entail the maximum in personal sacrifice. But if I were to ask, are you pro-choice? No, the woman in front of you. Yes. So if I were to ask you, if these people said they were going to fast unto the death, until these abortions stop, would that move you? No. And she shakes her head emphatically, no. Of course not. She's probably thinking, I hope they fast until the death, and I hope they drop dead. Which tells you that it's not just means that will reach a public. It's also just ends, goals. And so in order to try, as Muin said, to set a strategy that mobilizes people, we have to be very careful that we set ourselves a goal that will reach people. If you overreach in your goal, you're going to lose people. And if you overreach in your goal, instead of creating a movement, you're simply going to build a cult. Instead of building a movement, you're going to end up creating a cult. The two are very different. Mr. Gandhi, most of you know his political life as a leader of the Indian independence movement. But he had a second simultaneous life. He was an ashram leader. And in his ashram, which is like a cult, in his ashram he was very strict. He was a very strict taskmaster. No meat, obviously, because he's a vegetarian. No sex, brahmacharya. But no underwear, he thought that was a Western idea. No joking while doing chores. No reading in the toilet. No wrist watches. And he enforced this on every member of his ashram. And he used to have them keep a book. What do you do every minute of every day? Because he thought there was nothing more sinful than squandering time. And he would read the book. He was a little big brother. But Gandhi was smart and shrewd enough a politician to recognize that you couldn't use the standard of an ashram if you want to build a mass movement among the Indian people. It's a different standard. Having said that, what should be the standard of the Palestine movement? And here I think the answer is very straightforward and uncontroversial. Because if you look at every representative body in the world today, every representative political body in the world today, or if you look at the most respected political bodies in the world today, whichever angle you look at it, from the most representative to the most respected, you come to the same conclusion. The whole of international public opinion, in its most democratic and its most progressive forums, they've embraced the two-state settlement on the June 1967 border, a full Israeli withdrawal from the whole of the West Bank, the whole of Gaza, including, in the case of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and what's called a just resolution of the refugee question. So, because time is limited, let's just take a couple of examples. So if I were to ask you, what's the most representative political body in the world today, you would say, yeah, the United Nations General Assembly. And every year the UN General Assembly votes in a resolution titled Peaceful Resolution of the Palestine Question. Actually, it votes literally this minute every year, the end of November. I'm not sure what the vote is this year. It usually comes out in early December. In any case, they vote on a two-state settlement, full Israeli withdrawal, just settlement of the Palestinian refugee question. To give you the typical votes across the past decade, 1997, the vote, 155-2, the whole world on one side, Israel and the United States on the other side. 2004, the vote, 161-7, the whole world on one side, Israel, the U.S., Australia, Grenada, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, and Palau on the other side. 2010, this past year, the vote, 165-7, the whole world on one side, Israel, the United States, Australia, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, and Palau on the other side. For those of you who are laughing, I know that sound of the embarrassed laughter. You hear Nauru and Palau, funny names, but you don't know what they are, and you're college educated, so you're a little bit embarrassed. Truth be told, I didn't know much about them either. I can tell you without trying to disparage small countries that their entire populations can easily fit in the empty seats in this room, with room left over, and also in the case of these countries, because of global warming, they probably will not be voting in any more of these UN. No, that's not, you shouldn't be applauding that. Some of you are thinking, but what about those Arab countries, those terrible, anti-Semitic, crazy, fanatical Arab countries? And yes, there are 22 of those countries in the world that belong to this organization called the Arab League. And the Arab League in March 2002 it put forth what's come to be called the Arab Peace Initiative. And the Arab Peace Initiative says we support a two-state settlement in the June 1967 border, a just resolution of the refugee question, echoing the sentiment of the United Nations General Assembly. Then some of you are thinking, what about those Muslim countries? And indeed, there are 57 Muslim countries. They belong to the Organization of the Islamic Conference. And the Organization of the Islamic Conference, it too adopted the Arab Peace Initiative supporting a two-state settlement in the June 67 border, just resolution of the refugee question. And it's important to bear in mind that among the members of the OIC, those 57 Muslim countries, is the Islamic Republic of Iran, which has supported the two-state settlement on the June 67 border and the just resolution of the refugee question. And since 2004, if you look at the UN General Assembly vote, and I urge you to do so on your own, it's the resolution, I'll repeat, is entitled Peaceful Settlement of the Palestine Question. You'll see Iran, since 2004, has been voting with the majority, voting with the rest of the world, apart from the US, Israel, Micronesia, Nauru, and Palau. If that's the most representative body in the world, then if I were to ask what is the most respected legal body in the world, you would respond, well, ask Susan because she teaches law. The International Court of Justice, the International Court of Justice consisting of 15 judges from representative countries in the world. And in fact, the International Court of Justice in 2004, it rendered what's called an advisory opinion on the Israel-Palestine conflict. I don't have time now to go through the context of the opinion it rendered, but let me go through very quickly some of the substantive results of their opinion, which are relevant to this. Number one, the International Court of Justice ruled that the whole of the West Bank, the whole of Gaza, these are occupied Palestinian territories. These are the areas which, as the court put it, are designated for Palestinian self-determination. Number two, the International Court of Justice ruled that East Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory. It is exactly in its legal status the same as the West Bank and Gaza. It is a part of the designated unit for Palestinian self-determination. Number three, the International Court of Justice ruled that all the settlements are illegal, all the Jewish settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, all 500,000 settlers, they are all illegal under international law. They are a flagrant violation of international law. Now, bear in mind what that means, because every time you open the newspaper or you turn on the radio and then you listen to the dreadful NPR or the dreadful BBC, they always refer to the occupied territories as the disputed territories. But according to the highest judicial body in the world, there's no dispute whatsoever. These are occupied Palestinian territories. If you listen to the radio, read the newspaper, they'll tell you that the settlements are controversial. But in fact, there's no controversy whatsoever about the legal status of those settlements. None at all. All the settlements under international law are illegal under international law. Now, I want to give you some sense about how lacking in controversy these issues are. We're told settlements, Jerusalem, borders, and I'll get to in a moment the refugees, we're told these are such controversial issues that they have to be put off, deferred to the end of negotiations, because they're so controversial that negotiations will break down if we start talking about them immediately. They're called the final status issues, or sometimes the permanent status issues. Controversial? Well, let's look at that court opinion. There are 15 judges in that court. Two of them, incidentally, are Jewish. Rosalind Higgins from the UK, she's married to an Irishman, and Thomas Bergenfeld, the American judge, who's a Holocaust survivor and Jewish. On the points to which I just referred, borders, Jerusalem, settlements, not a single judge, not one, on the International Court of Justice registered a dissent. Not one. On the broader issue that the court was addressing, which I can't get into now, the legality of the wall that Israel is building in the West Bank, the vote was 14-1. The negative vote was cast by the American judge, Bergenfeld. But even Bergenfeld said in his opinion, he wrote a separate opinion, not a dissent, he wrote a separate opinion. Even Bergenfeld said in his separate opinion, there's much in what the majority said that I agree with. And he said, I have to agree with the majority that the settlements are illegal under international law. There's no controversy. For those of you who follow the International Court of Justice, it's very unusual. These are very independent-minded, you could say contentious judges. But when it came to these issues, there was no dissent. And there was no dissent because there's nothing controversial at all about them in the law. They are just very straightforward issues of law. And that leaves the last question, the question of the refugees. Now, it's true that the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, didn't address it because it wasn't relevant to what they were adjudicating, but the major human rights organizations have addressed it. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, in 2000-2001, they issued opinion papers and policy statements on the question of the refugees. And both Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, they both agreed that under international law, the Palestinians and what they called their terms, succeeding generations that have maintained genuine links with the land, the original Palestinian refugees, and succeeding generations that have maintained genuine links with the land, that they have the right of return. So, there are two conclusions that follow from what I have to say. The first conclusion is that this is the consensus of international opinion, both in its most representative and its respected bodies. This is where international opinion is at. It calls for a two-state settlement of the Israel-Palestine conflict on this June 67 border and a just resolution of the refugee question. The first conclusion is, on every significant issue bearing on the Israel-Palestine conflict, the Israeli position has no standing whatsoever. They have lost in the court of public opinion. Their position has been repudiated across the board. That is, you might say, the bright side of the picture. There is a broad public that's ready to hear a simple message. The message is, enforce the law. That's what we want to do. We want to enforce the law. But there's a second conclusion, which is, in my opinion, just as important as the first. It is important trying to reach the broad public. The second conclusion is important in terms of ourselves, that is, people who are activists in the movement. And that is, the law is clear. Israel is a member state of the United Nations. It has the same rights and obligations as any other member state. And therefore, from the point of view of the law, if you're talking about enforcing the law, that means one, that means two states. Does not mean one state. There's nothing in the law and nothing in the representative institutions that speaks about one state. Now, some of you might feel, well, I don't agree with that. I think it's wrong. And truth be told, probably you can make a very compelling argument saying why it's wrong. But in my opinion, that's not politics. Because politics is not about your opinion or your opinion or your opinion or my opinion. That's not politics. Politics is about, exactly as Gandhi put it, it's where public opinion is at, where you can reach them. And the thing about politics is, if you overreach public opinion, you end up in a cult. So, a concrete example. I told you, if 20 people blocked that boulevard in front of my house and said, we're trying to awaken the conscience of people to give their coats, I would do it. I know it. I know me. But wait, I'm no saint. If they blocked the boulevard and they said, not to give your coat, but to give a room in your house to the homeless, well, I'll tell you, I think the person who says that has the moral argument on his or her side. If we want to use the proverbial standard, what would Jesus do? Well, I think Jesus would say, give your room. I do. And I'm not proud to have to say, I won't do it. I'm ready to give my coat. I do have room in my apartment. I can't lie about that. I do. And sometimes I get very torn and twisted inside me. I think I really should give that room. But I won't. And if the people block the boulevard and demanded the room, they lose the public. Even if, morally, they have the stronger argument. And I think it's the same thing here. You can make 1,000 morally compelling arguments why it should be one state. And probably you'd have a lot of right on your side, and you may be able to best me in the argument. But that's not what politics is about. Politics is about where public opinion is at. And if we don't want to lapse into a cult, and more importantly, if we want to take advantage, exploit that political opportunity that's opened up for us, we have to be very careful about gauging our goal to reach public opinion, but not to so overreach it that we miss the opportunity.
You have been listening to Norman Finkelstein speaking at Boston University on solving the Israeli-Palestine conflict. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.